Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, happy to be sitting opposite Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, paying his final visit to the Morning Show for 2019. We were just reminiscing about how many of these programs we've done over the course of his 15 years, soon to be 16 years as president of Gateway. Once a month, you've been paying these visits to the program, and it's always fun to be able to do this.
I can't believe it's the last one of the year for 2019, Greg. The time goes so fast. And speaking of fast, I mean, 15 years just flew by. Yeah. I feel like it's almost day one. I'm learning so much about Gateway and the communities we serve, and exciting times for all of us, and certainly for everyone here at Gateway Technical College. So good morning.
Very good. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
We'll introduce our special guest in just a moment. We're very excited to have our guest. But first, a couple of Gateway items that I know you want to talk about, including the end of this semester and the start of a new one coming up in early January.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's so many unique activities that go on at Gateway, but nothing is as special as graduation and the completion ceremonies that our students go through. And just this last week alone, as we ended our semester last Saturday, I had a chance to attend our nurse pinning ceremony, largest graduating class in the history of Gateway. 85 nurses graduated.
Wow.
We had over 800 community members attend the event. It was really very special, and I think something that is important for our community to remember is that it takes students a lot more sometimes than 2 years to graduate from Gateway. So there's a lot of compelling stories about challenges that students have gone through in order to complete their degree, and great to have that. And later this morning, actually, we're gonna swear in some new police officers at our Law Enforcement Academy graduation. Always an inspiring event, and all the police chiefs attend, and it's very patriotic and very emotional for families to see their sons and daughters graduate as police officers. I'm so thrilled that last week we also graduated our GED, HSED, English language learners, and it's really remarkable. And when you run on a three-semester calendar, there's not any one set day that's graduation. It's like every 15 weeks there's another group completing. So very proud of all of them. Congratulations to all our grads.
Feels good to see that happening.
You bet.
I also know that you want to highlight a couple of different partnerships with Gateway that you're very excited about. And I'm especially intrigued to know what the partnership is with eSports. Tell us about that.
You know, I'm learning about it myself. So sometimes things, the world goes really fast and you don't really pay attention all that close, but eSports is computer gaming in our schools. And so colleges and universities and high schools all across Wisconsin, the nation, the globe are competing against each other in computer games. Hmm. And so Gateway is going to announce today, a little bit later at our college board meeting, that we are going to also start eSports so our students can form a team and then have competitions and have a chance to demonstrate and practice their skills around computer gaming. And some people might ask, well, what does that have to do with education and why are we paying for all of that activity, right? Well, it's coding, so it's computer coding. It's team building skills. It's a way to take a look at future careers in broadcasting. And there's an actual competitive market for it. There are scholarships, and I know Marquette University just announced their new scholarship program. It's a varsity letter sport, actually, at Marquette.
Wow.
Milwaukee School of Engineering. So whether you're in IT, engineering, or just like computer games, eSports is a way to bring the community together around educational initiatives and give students a chance to demonstrate their skills and then leverage those into a career.
Very good. Finally, I know you want to tell us about the Ford NGL partnership. That's another one you're going to have to explain to me.
Right.
I mean, I know what a Ford is.
Yeah, there you go. Right. And it actually is based on Ford trucks and Ford cars. They have a foundation that helps to build academies. So you may have heard of the Academies of Racine.
Yeah.
So Ford NGL has partnered with the city of Racine, the school district, to create the Ford NGL Academy Partnership. And we are going to be serving as a convening agent for the Racine Unified Schools and Ford NGL to build community advocacy and community awareness around helping students experience college life and work-based learning programs. So partnership between K-12, the two-year technical college, and our business partners to establish relationships where students can go back and forth between the three entities, gain some work experience, get some college credit, and graduate from high school. So really excited about that. We had a team this last week actually at the national conference to get more information, and we're going to invite Cheryl Carrier, the executive director for Ford NGL, back to Racine this spring. We'll sign our official MOU between the three parties, and I'll invite her to be on our radio program with us, so you'll get to meet Cheryl.
Very good. Looking forward to that.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to meeting our special guest who is right with us in the studios. So tell our listeners why you have invited Kelvin Alfaro today.
So you might remember, Greg, several years ago, Jack Keating was a chancellor at UW-Parkside. And,
sure.
And Jack was the inspiration behind an initiative for the state of Wisconsin called Campus Compact. It's a national organization, but Jack was really the champion to help build a Wisconsin contingent. And it's a collaborative effort between two-year, four-year public and private colleges and universities to build the ideas around service into our programming. And so Jack invited me, and I was really proud and honored to be able to serve with him on the board for Wisconsin Campus Compact. And eventually Chancellor Ford took over that responsibility. So between Jack, myself, and Debbie, we've had a long tenure in developing relationships around service learning. And in that process, we've gone through several renovations or adaptions to Campus Compact, and it's evolved quite a bit. And so recently we hired a new chief executive, Kelvin, and I invited him to share a little perspective on how that organization has evolved, how it's changed, and what it means to two- and four-year campuses across the state of Wisconsin, and how we can improve civic engagement and student involvement in our communities.
Sounds great. It sounds like very, very laudable goals indeed. So it's great to be able to welcome to our studios Kelvin Alfaro, and you are executive director of the Wisconsin Campus Compact. So we're happy to have you here on the morning show. Let's begin by having you tell us a little bit about where you are from originally and kind of your professional pathway that eventually took you to Wisconsin Campus Compact.
Well, thank you both for having me here today. I am excited to hear and share my story. Yes, so I am actually new to the state of Wisconsin. I'm originally from California. And I'd like to really share a little bit about, you know, sort of my path in this to this role. And so I usually like to start that with sharing a little perspective and story about where my country of origin, which is El Salvador. So I came to the United States in 1993 after my family sought refuge in the 80s from the civil strife that was happening in El Salvador. And the story that was shared to me was that of transitioning from a third world country to a first world country. And the reality was that I transitioned from a third world country to a third world community within a first world country. And so that has really colored my experiences in life and has really shaped where I position myself in my career. So I have always been very grateful for the opportunities that I had from the faith-based, from the nonprofits, from the higher education institutions and mentors that I had that really have led to where I am today. Hmm. I really feel that this experience of growing up poor, of growing up in a rural disadvantaged community is something that is shared by many other community members throughout the United States, but also here in the state of Wisconsin. And so I really think that there's a lot of resonance to that.
Is this your first visit to Wisconsin, though? The first job? You grew up in California. That's got to be a little bit different to move all the way to Wisconsin.
It is. It certainly is. It is my first 6 months in the state of Wisconsin. Like I mentioned before then, I was in California, sunny California, all the time. And to wrap up the first question on my history, I was going to share that my background has been in the nonprofit sector. I've spent 10 years with California State University, California's Central Valley Community Foundation, in which I was the director of programs and evaluation. And then before that, I was with United Way, and then I had a long-term partnership with California State University, Fresno, doing civic engagement work with their nonprofit management training program.
Wow. So you've had a real passion for this for a long, long time. I mean, even from the early part of your life, you had a sense of what can make a difference in people's lives and wanting to be an agent for that.
Yes, giving back to the community and really helping to co-create access to opportunity has always been a passion of mine.
Yeah, very good.
That is exciting when you think about the differences between all of your experience from El Salvador to California, different markets, different needs, all the way here to Wisconsin, and yet it's still about making sure that people have access to services and they understand how they can be a part of growing a community. And so there's values that are similar across the globe, and yet the experiences that people bring to it are so different.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. So I think it would be helpful for our listeners if you would describe to them what the Campus Compact is. How is it put together and who belongs to it?
Yeah. So Campus Compact, as Brian mentioned, is a national coalition of colleges and universities throughout the United States who are committed to the public purposes of higher education. And so we build democracy through civic education and through community partnership. And so what that means for me is an opportunity to take students and help them practice what they're learning in the classroom in a community setting through authentic partnerships, through really getting to know the community members themselves. And I find that this is especially exciting for me because as we look at the lay of the political landscape in the United States, we can see that the ability to converse with other groups that are not within your own group is such an important and needed trait. And so I think in addition to all the other benefits of community-based learning, the opportunity to engage with others is such a critical skill set that students get from this experience.
And you're saying this is an experience in which that can happen in a really rich way.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and there's so many different venues to make it happen. At Gateway here, we call it our Civic Action Plan. So faculty are involved, students are involved, community nonprofit organizations are involved, industry is involved. So there's a network of services and support within the community to talk about these types of issues and to have a platform and an organization where we can learn from other educational institutions really helps add value to the enrichment experiences we provide students.
So, for instance, Wisconsin Campus Compact, how many colleges and universities are we talking about that belong to it?
Yeah, so I think I shared that over the United States, it's about 1,000 colleges and universities that are part of this network. In Wisconsin, we have about 25 colleges and universities that are part of the network. There is a great opportunity there, though, because overall, there's over 100 institutions of higher learning within the state of Wisconsin. So we're just beginning to make a dent in this.
Oh, okay. So in other words, there's room for growth.
There is room for growth, yes.
More schools becoming part of this. President Albrecht has already kind of touched on former UW Parkside Chancellor Jack Keating as being the person who really helped get this started. Did he help get this started on a state level?
On the state level, right. Okay. Yeah, you know, he's very passionate, as I think all the presidents and chancellors have a sense of responsibility to help their students become good citizens. And some of that happens in the classroom and some of it happens outside the classroom, and to create a forum for those two connections to come together and create an intersection. And Jack was very passionate about that and really helped to build, at least in our region, Southeast Wisconsin, the identity of service, and then to carry that at the state level.
Fantastic. So, Kelvin Alfaro, do you end up having to have some kind of physical presence in all of these 25 different schools that at the moment are part of Wisconsin Campus Compact, or are you mostly sitting in front of a screen trying to keep connected to all of these different schools?
You know, that's one of the most exciting parts of my job is the ability to connect with in person with some of these institutions, to visit and observe their campuses and look at what kind of exciting work that they're engaging their students in. So, the last 6 months I've spent traveling the state of Wisconsin. I haven't finished exactly visiting everyone, but I have visited the majority of colleges and universities that are part of the network. And that is part of my role. My role involves both in-person activities, like a big event that we're planning next year is called the Civic Engagement Institute for 2020, where we bring faculty, students as an opportunity to share best practices and what's happening within the state of Wisconsin. But I also do a lot of webinars and opportunities for faculty to learn and infuse new best practices into their work.
I think it's your second or maybe third time already visiting Gateway.
This is my second time here, yes.
So we're really proud to have you back on campus. And I know the last time you were here, you actually had a chance to go out and visit with some other folks on campus and learn a little bit more about, in this case, the technical college system. Mm-hmm. But are you finding unique differences between the technical colleges and maybe the four-year universities or the private universities?
Yeah, I'm still learning a lot about the differences between each and exactly how my support can be most beneficial to each of the different models. And so it's been a good learning opportunity. And I think one of the key differences that I've seen is that, the amount of time that's available for students to engage in this work and how that has to be different for technical colleges as compared to students that are in a four-year institution.
Very good point. Yeah, two-year degrees, one-year diploma programs, there's not as much time that you're actually face-to-face with students. And in our world, that we actually have some really great partnerships with UW-Parkside as well. So students get to collaborate and work between the two institutions. And I think that continues to add additional experience for our students as they think about moving on to a baccalaureate degree or how the university students can participate in some of the more applied experiences that we have here on our campus.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, today's morning show marks President Brian Albrecht's final monthly visit of 2019 to the morning show. And our guest, who is in the studio with us, is Kelvin Alfaro, who is Executive Director of Wisconsin Campus Compact. And this is a state organization, actually part of a national organization, but the state organization is a coalition of 25-some colleges and universities who are all engaged in trying to give their students very rich service learning opportunities in which part of their education involves connecting with the community in some really tangible ways. So, Kelvin Alfaro, you've touched on this already, but let's give you a chance to dig a little deeper into what some of the benefits are for a student when they engage in service in the community. What are the ways in which their educational experience is actually enriched and enhanced?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, a couple of the benefits include the ability to practice what they're learning in the classroom in a community setting. I think the other most important benefit is that students get to develop soft skills that are transferable from career to career. And so the opportunity to work together in collaboration with a team of their peers, as well as a team of other professionals in the community itself, is such an important skill. The ability to communicate effectively between them is such an important skill that transfers from career to career. And so those are some of the soft skills that they get to learn. But they also get to become better citizens, better informed about the challenges that are in their community and what they can do about them.
Yeah, I think it's excellent, and I just can reflect a little bit on Gateway. We just completed our annual report, and Maddie shared with me that there's over 10,000 hours of community volunteerism by Gateway students, and
wow.
It comes in all different ways, Greg. So you may recall we hold a special event on campus for the Boys and Girls Club where they get experience in personal health and hygiene. They get a chance to meet some of our law enforcement students, so they learn about self-protection, and so they're giving of their occupation and their career. We also have a really great international program, which is all based on service. So our nursing students will go to Nicaragua and provide healthcare services. And so we try to find ways to engage at the occupational level. And then, of course, this time of year, I mean, you see it on campus, right? We're doing food drives and clothing drives and, jacket, coat drives and things, and trying to find ways so that our students can experience our community in new ways. And it's not just about collecting those items, it's about then going to the different venues, Halo or the Shalom Center, and talking to their leadership and what the needs are, and they build that understanding and create a deeper value for the service they provide to our community.
And I suppose just plain old awareness, I mean,
oh, absolutely.
Of what the community is, who comprises the community, and especially some of those pockets of the community where there are real need. So you're not just hearing about it, but you're seeing it with your own eyes.
Absolutely. Seeing it and being a part of maybe building a richer community, you know, by participating. And so it's sometimes easy to stand on the sidelines and say, oh, I wish our community would do more. It's more difficult to jump into the game and say, let me help, you know, and that's what this is all about.
Very good. So, Kelvin Ofaro, tell us about some of the resources that are available through Wisconsin Campus Compact in terms of helping students experience what we've been talking about.
Yeah, so there's different levels of services that Campus Compact provides, both at the national, Midwest, and also the state level. So I'll start from the top down. At the national level, we provide a lot of different conference opportunities. One coming up is going to be the Compact 20, which is our national convening for not only presidents and staff to come together and have a large conference where they get to learn and imbue new skills into their work. We also have what's called a Midwest Campus Compact Conference that'll be happening in 2021. A couple other services that we offer that are from the national office include an AmeriCorps Vista program, which is an opportunity to access funding that allows students to engage in capacity building projects within the university or within a nonprofit partnership. We also have the Newman Civic Fellows program that's available, again, a similar fashion of allowing resources for a student to work on capacity building projects within the university. At a more local level, a couple of things that my position does include helping institutions tell better stories about the impact of their work. We also do something that Brian mentioned earlier, which is the civic action planning, helping institutions develop a plan of action for how they will engage students and their communities in this work. Another big thing is that I do essentially on-site tailored trainings and consultations for colleges and universities. I am a thought partner that can help resolve and troubleshoot some of the issues that colleges and universities may be experiencing.
I think it's remarkable. There's a lot of resources and just sort of a tangible way to think about it that just recently took part here at Gateway. So the Vista Volunteer Program. So that was an important aspect for us when we originally started. We wrote for a grant, and that's actually how we brought Maddie onto the campus. And then we ended up hiring her full-time because she's an outstanding employee and has a really vast knowledge in the area of engagement. But one of the activities that might be resonating with her people, we're also a partner with the United Way in helping build volunteerism for the Volunteer Tax Income Initiative, so the VITA program, which is a direct result of Maddie's initiatives to get community engagement for specific programs. So the impact is system-wide at the college level, but it's also personal at the individual level when someone is able to get that support to fill out their tax returns and get money back and that they may not have had before, which adds additional income for the community. And it's a remarkable network of experiences, and you can't just pick one item out and say, oh, if we only did this one thing, it's a domino effect that affects the entire community.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot of this is about building a sense of civic responsibility, which is so important in this day and age. What would you say are some of the most important ways in which that takes place here?
Yeah, so different colleges and universities do this in different ways, but a lot of the some of the low-hanging fruit when it comes to civic engagement include things like helping students, you know, be registered to vote. So a voting drive. Those are non-political activities. And then another one that's really important that will be coming up in the next year is the census 2020. So we know a lot of students go undercounted. When we look at census tracts in which institutions of higher learning sit within the state of Wisconsin, the majority of those census tracts are underrepresented. And partly is because students aren't really sure exactly how they should be counting. Are my parents counting me at home? I'm just here visiting temporarily. And so the importance of colleges and universities informing students about what does it mean to be counted, and how does that impact the resources that are available in their community is such a critical component. And many of them already in doing some of that work.
That is so important, too. And just the one idea, I'm glad you brought it up, Census 2020. It's hard to even imagine how important this is, because it affects all of your federal aid, as an example.
Right.
I heard just recently that every single individual adds to about $13,000 of additional potential income for your community. So if you miss people or people aren't counted, that's less resource available for your community to grow. So it's important that we have access to the population density that we serve, so we have equal access to the investment that it needs in order to support it.
Right. And Kelvin Alfaro, because your own background is one that involves some poverty, and we know that communities of poverty often are undercounted in census, so I'm sure this is of special, in a sense, personal concern for you.
Right. Yeah. It's. I have been involved in promoting the census since the last one in California, but importantly here, I think in Wisconsin, there's a great opportunity for improving the services that are available for people who are of lesser means. Right. So we've got to do what needs to be done to get counted.
Yeah. Absolutely. What about does Wisconsin Campus Compact focus exclusively on people who are of a collegiate age, I mean, in the standard sense of the word, or do you think very much about even younger people already getting kind of a sense of engagement with the community? Is Campus Compact at all involved in that, even in a secondhand way?
Most likely in a secondhand way, and with our community partnerships with nonprofit organizations. But you're right. The point about anybody can be involved in volunteerism or service is an important point to make, because you know, when you look at the statistics around crime, it really boils down to how engaged are we with our neighbors? Do we know our neighbor's name? We know that crime decreases when communities have these social bonds that are strengthened by knowing who your neighbors are, talking to your neighbors. And so the more people are just hunkered down in their own home and with their own social group, the more isolated and we are unable to really communicate and drive some of these issues forward that we're seeing in our communities.
We strive also to reach into the elementary, middle school, and high school grades to help students understand that perspective of service. And an example coming up very in the near future here, our Martin Luther King Day celebration is all around service, and we hold a day of service, and we engage youth, and we have an awards program for middle school students that are working in the community to do unique things. And we recognize and honor that value of service at all levels. It not only helps young people think about who they are and what they want to be, but also engages their parents a little bit more in helping their children make good decisions.
Wonderful. So, Kelvin Alfaro, what do we know in a real concrete way about the difference that this makes? And I suppose we could talk about it in two different ways. I mean, what kind of impact is this having on communities? And what kind of impact is this having on individual students in terms of their learning being enhanced? Has that been studied in any way or analyzed?
Yeah. So for the individual student level, there's a lot of different benefits that the research tells us. The one that I mentioned earlier, which is the development of social-emotional skills, is a very important one. But the opportunity to then work with other group members in the community and to practice what they're learning in the classroom is something that is enhances their learning, because there's an old adage of see one, teach one, do one, right? And so this civic learning model helps to infuse that learning even further. And for the impact that we see of community service in general in communities is that we have, again, better partnerships with nonprofits who are doing some of this work. better opportunity to bridge the divide that exists between higher education and communities, right? So we have the mentality that a lot of higher education is like an ivory tower and community members don't feel connected to it. So there's an opportunity to really connect with those community members in an authentic way that honors what communities have to teach higher education and what higher education has to bring to the table and to teach to community members as well.
And I think it makes it contextualizes the learning environment. So students learn better, we know, when they're engaged in their learning experience, right? If we can have students that are practicing accounting and now are providing a service through tax accounting, it all of a sudden it connects the curriculum in the classroom to the community, and that is a real rich and learning environment. And so when we try to identify partnerships or projects in the community, the more we can connect it to their own personal interests and how they can leverage that into support for the community, the better the learning experiences for the students.
I'm sure. So, Kelvin Alfaro, first of all, how long have you been with Wisconsin Campus Compact?
This is my seventh month.
Okay, so you're still relatively new on the job. Maybe this is a little early to ask you this, but I wonder, do you have at this point any goals in terms of where you hope Wisconsin Campus Compact can go from here? Any ways in which you think the work that they do can be maybe enhanced or refocused or changed in some way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I've had an opportunity to work with a very rich group of leaders who serve on my leadership board, and we have been planning for what Campus Compact could for the state of Wisconsin could work on in the next couple of years. My overall vision for this position, though, is that I really want to help colleges and universities advance their thinking about what it means to engage in this work and how to integrate it more effectively into the core curriculum. And what does that look like? And what I really have been finding out is that how each college or university engages in this work and how I bring what resources I bring to the table have to be very tailored and specific depending on where they are on their learning curve, what type of institution they are, and then also whether they serve primarily rural communities versus urban communities. And all those variables differ as to how they see this work happening in their campus, and then also what I can effectively bring to the table. Ultimately, I think if we can have more presidents and chancellors think about this as a great opportunity to solidify student learning and to really bridge the communication with communities, I think that's going to be a big marker of success for reaching some of these goals.
Okay. Yeah, I think part of that identification of goals, Wisconsin has great pride in history in service. And I think to leverage the organization of Campus Compact to greater visibility, whether it's with legislators, elected officials, community college leaders, university leaders, and that will only inspire others to get involved and create a greater network of support with other nonprofit organizations. So while we concentrate on colleges and universities, there are other entities within Wisconsin that can add value to the resource question you have, but also to build that support fabric that is needed across our state.
Right. Well, towards that end then, who is it that can be involved in Wisconsin Campus Compact? And in a sense, who are you hoping to reach to become part of this?
Yeah, so our primary membership model right now focuses on colleges and universities. As I've been getting to know folks in the state of Wisconsin, I have also seen the importance of getting to know the nonprofit sector itself, because these are very valuable partners. And so I'm looking to partner with nonprofits, other nonprofits, and to really help essentially to be an effective matchmaker between the work that they're doing and either faculty with research experience or programs within colleges and universities that are a good fit for each other. Students can get involved with Campus Compact. As I mentioned, two opportunities earlier, the AmeriCorvista program and the Newman's Fellows program are both geared at students and not only providing them some resources, but then also providing them a structure for them to develop in their personal development.
Very good.
I think what's great about that is there's a statewide way for nonprofits to get involved. But there's also a local way. So if there are folks listening to the program today and they're thinking, hey, how do I get connected back to Gateway to create a partnership? We have a whole system in place. So all you have to do is contact, in this case, Gateway or UW Parkside, and we can connect you to the right faculty, to the right student groups, and really try to build that relationship so that we can leverage the resources of each other's organizations.
Fantastic. So if people want more information about Wisconsin Campus Compact, where's the best place to go?
I don't have the most memorable URL, if people are interested in getting to know more about the work, they can visit wicampuscompact.org. So wicampuscompact.org. You can certainly just Google us, and we'll come up on the first link.
Right, and there's all kinds of information there on your website that will enlighten people further, then, it sounds
like. Yep, as well as my contact information and ways in which they can get involved.
Great. Well, Kevin Alfaro, it was great to, first of all, hear your wonderful and unique story and also to learn more about Wisconsin Campus Compact and the important difference that this is making in the lives of a whole lot of students and in the hearts of many communities. So we wish you well with this important work as you go forward from here, and we're really glad you were part of the morning show today.
Great. Thank you for having me, Greg.
Glad to have you here. And President Brian Albrecht, it's always great to have you here, and we look forward to more conversations in 2020.
Very good. Happy holidays, Greg.
You too. It's 8:46, and you are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out today's morning show, I'm going to be replaying a portion of a conversation I recorded back in 2007 with Michael Pollan, talking about his best-known book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, which, among other things, describes the ways in which our relationship with food and the level of our understanding of our food and where it comes from has drastically deteriorated in recent years.
You know, for thousands of years, humans have figured out what to eat without a lot of expert help. And suddenly we find ourselves in this position where we're listening to journalists and to nutritionists and to doctors to decide what really is a kind of fundamental creaturely question: what should we have for dinner? And one of the things I set out to answer in Omnivore's Dilemma is why did it get so complicated? And part of the reason, and it occurred to me too at a certain point, that a book that tried to figure out where our food comes from is not a book that you could have written 100 years ago, because everybody knew where their food came from. You wouldn't pay to read a book to find out something as ordinary. It's right. Like buying a book on how to breathe.
Well, you even if the book were free, you wouldn't bother
you wouldn't invest the time. But of course, now we don't know where our food comes from. Children, you know, have no idea. I tell a story about being online at McDonald's, and there's a girl asking about where do hamburgers come from, and her dad says they come from cows, and she says, "Oh, like milk." And, well, it's not exactly like milk.
I want to ask especially about a moment in the introduction when you talk about the lack of a steadying culture of food leaves us especially vulnerable to the blandishments of the food scientists and the marketer, for whom the omnivore's dilemma is not so much a dilemma as an opportunity. What exactly do you mean there by the lack of a steadying culture of food here in the United States?
Well, for most of history, and you still find this if you go to other countries with a really vibrant food culture, I'm thinking of countries like Italy or France, the decision about what to eat is really determined by your cultural environment. And culture is really just a fancy word for your mother. I mean, you know, when it comes to food, basically mothers for most of history have determined what you're going to eat, how much of it you're going to eat, what you're going to eat it with, who you're going to eat it with. And that, you know, you didn't have to make a whole lot of decisions. People, the force of tradition and habit basically determined the dinner menu. And if you look at our culture, though, things have changed a lot. Odds are that you do not eat the same food that your mother ate as a child. And she may not even eat the same food she ate as a child, where there's this incredible amount of churn going on in the American diet. And that is partly because historically we've never had a really strong culture of food because we're an immigrant nation made up of lots of different cultures, none of which kind of dominated. I mean, I suppose English more than any, but that's not too great when it comes to food. So as a result, we are really vulnerable to outside influences, whether that is, and usually that takes the form of food marketers, companies coming along and selling us on new foods. That, you know, you should eat fast food, or you should eat, you know, gourmet food, or whatever is on sale at the supermarket. And so we change the way we eat more than most people do. Historically, you know, a food, what a culture eats is one of the hardest things to shake about it. And if you go to an immigrant's home, the last place to look for signs of assimilation are the refrigerator and the pantry.
That's where people hold on to their roots the most intently and determinedly.
But we're losing that. We're really losing those roots. And that's really unfortunate because culture has a lot of wisdom when it comes to food. What people have eaten for a long time tends to be healthy because people wouldn't remain, you know, healthy eating that, and they would stop eating it. And most traditional cuisines, you know, whatever the one it is, whether it's Asian or European or African, tend to be good ways to eat and far better ways to eat than the Western diet that most of us have adopted, which is a very novel diet, and we're learning is making people very sick.
We're speaking with Michael Pollan, and we're talking about his fascinating new book called The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. I do want to get into the balance of the book, but one other thing in the introduction I just think has to be talked about, because this is the kind of thing that we so take for granted. You talk about the ways in which human beings are different from most of nature's other eaters. You say markedly so, in the way that we modify the food chains we depend on by means of such revolutionary technologies as cooking with fire, hunting with tools, farming, and preserving food. I mean, it's just so funny to think of those things as revolutionary technologies because they've been with us for so long that we've forgotten all about the way in which they reshaped the whole act of eating.
Tremendously. I mean, we've had several revolutions in eating, and you're right to say that cooking was one of the first, and that was a huge deal because it gave us a tremendous edge over other creatures. We could eat things they couldn't eat because we knew how to cook them. Something like various tubers that are poisonous if they're raw, when we learned we could cook them, things like potatoes, suddenly we had this, you know, vast store of new nutritional stuff, and that allowed us to grow. And cooking also makes food much more digestible. And there are anthropologists who believe that the growth of the human brain really begins when we can cook and unlock that storehouse of protein, fat, and carbohydrate. And then you have the invention of agriculture, too, where we moved from being hunter-gatherers and settled down and started growing food, and that had a tremendous effect. Not all good, by the way. It was really bad for our health. In a way, it was sort of like the coming of fast food more recently, that this whole new diet made people sick for a long time, partly because we were keeping animals. We started picking up diseases from them, but also because we weren't that good at farming, and we would run out of food and have these famines, or we'd eat too much of one thing, like all potatoes or all wheat, and suffer nutritional deficiencies. We were actually much healthier as hunter-gatherers. And so there was this initial period. In fact, we're just regaining our stature, our physical stature we had before the birth of agriculture. We sort of shrunk and got weaker with the birth of agriculture, and now we're coming back to where we were as hunter-gatherers in terms of our physical stature. And now we're having another revolution right now, and I think that is a big part of the problem that you're seeing, is that we've changed our diet more in the last 100 years than we have in the previous 1,000 since the birth of agriculture. And one of the ways we've done this is doing things like refining grain, into white flour, making sugar, pure sugar, and making that common and available. These kind of transformations have had a profound effect on our biology, and they're the reason that we're getting fat and suffering from diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, diseases that really are not common in people eating a more traditional diet. Hmm.
What's kind of odd, it seems to me a kind of a strange dichotomy in the situation, is that on the one hand, you have a lot of us, I'm one of them, that spend a little too much time in drive-thrus and eating fast food on the run, this and that. In fact, you quote a statistic in your book someplace about how many American meals are eaten in one's car. Eaten in one's car.
20% of our eating takes place in the car right now.
So there are a whole lot of us that are rather careless about what we eat, and we gravitate towards all these things that are not particularly good for us. But on the other hand, you also open up your book with you know, sort of expressing frustration at sort of the kind of irrational ways in which some people are trying to be very careful about what they eat, but to the point of absurdity where people stop eating bread or stop eating other central staples in our diet. I mean, does that strike you as well as kind of a strange, two-sided situation?
It's part of our dysfunction as eaters. I mean, in the same way that we don't have this steadying food culture, it leaves us vulnerable to these food fads. And we do, you know, we all say we want to eat healthily, and we're great consumers of health information about food. And so when...
Well, some people do. I mean, some people don't care much about that at all.
Well, that's true. There are people who just go ahead and eat whatever they want to eat. But there is a large population in America that when a new study comes out saying, you know, we should be more worried about carbohydrates than fat, suddenly you've got millions of Americans shopping in a whole new way, and the supermarket has to completely revise what they're selling, and suddenly you've got low-carb beer and low-carb everything, and they're reformulating the pasta and the bread, and donut businesses go out of business, and bakeries go out of business. So, you know, the food industry is at the mercy of these food fads, and they come and go, and there's always that new diet. And right now, you know, the carbohydrate is being demonized, and fat is being rehabilitated. And, yeah, there are people who aren't paying attention to that, but there are a whole lot of people who are. And it really does get kind of crazy. I talk in the book about what I call the American paradox, that you've got a population that worries more about health and food than just about anyone on the earth, but is one of the least healthy eaters on the earth.
Yeah, there it is, and the word paradox is a great term. I'm reminded of the chef Julia Child, who would say that, I mean, she was tremendously healthy and lived a long, long life, and she just enjoyed a bountiful array of different kinds of food. And as far as she was concerned, that's the only way to eat and the only way to eat healthfully.
Well, you know, you can eat a lot of food and you can eat a lot of different things, but she was eating real food. You know, she was eating food made from raw ingredients, stuff, you know, products of nature, not industry. And my guess is she was not eating a whole lot of fast food. I probably would have, you know, not satisfied her palate. But, you know, you look at the French. I mean, that's the classic example. I mean, these are people who really enjoy their vittles and eat lots of saturated fat and drink lots of red wine. And guess what? They're healthier than we are. What they're not doing is snacking all day long. They don't eat huge portions. They eat at these leisurely communal meals where people tend not to gorge and eat more slowly. Eating slowly is very, very important. Because it takes your gut about 20 minutes to tell your brain you're full. So if you're eating fast, you're not giving your body a chance to tell you when to stop. So, you know, we've got a lot to learn from other food cultures, and it's not about depriving yourself. It's about eating in a way that can be pleasurable and healthy. I mean, these are not contradictory. The problem comes up when you're eating, you know, things I don't even call food. I call them food products, you know, things that are the product of food science rather than industry. And I'm talking about processed foods. I think that's really where we get into trouble.
Michael Pollan is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, published by Penguin. This interview was recorded back in 2007. Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be telling you about several newly published books that perhaps should figure on your Christmas list. And among them will be the latest thriller by best-selling author David Baldacci. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website.